I was going to ask you about what you saw in Swamp Boogie Queen and why you signed them and everything like that. I don't have to do that now. I just talked to him for 40 minutes.
Right. It was obviously a long and good one.
Well, obviously, she's going to be a star.
She's just a natural star. That's the first thing I ever noticed. You know, when I first met you, I told you that we met in truly a garage and atmosphere with candles and all kinds of smelly stuff going on. And I thought, well, you know, I think in my lifetime, you experience that rare moment, and it comes very, you know, rarely in the sense of the one-on-one kind of thing where you're watching somebody and you say, this is a star, you know, and you've heard that overused and abused so many times. But what Abby has for me is that understanding of all the requirements, and you see us just talking casually how we care about not only each other, but how she cares about other people. And you know, we've all gone through this business when they come up and go down. And I started very, very young in this business. And probably the most important lesson you learn is to pay attention to what talent is and how it can develop, because it's a landscape, you know. It's a canvas, and very few of us get to play on all the fields that we're asked to play on. And I feel very lucky about and very fortunate about my persona, because I can lay in the back and watch and observe and give, and then see who takes and how they receive the information, what they do with it, how they pretend or don't pretend to understand. Because the knocks and the stuff that goes on, it's amazing that an audience gets to like anybody, and then the fact that they do get to be loved and then adored. And the facts are, reality of your life goes on and on, and you need a guide. And part of our life, people who work backstage for artists, is to keep them focused so that they see the reality and have the creative juices all the time. Now, I see them. We've been out 3 days. And this is the same group. Todd and Abby are the same two people I met 3 years ago. They haven't changed at all. They're the same dream, the comic book, all of the things that she's talked about, and the music probably. Her dream of rock and roll is kind of the way I describe rock and roll for me. You know, you might say, why am I here? Well, the one part of rock and roll that's the best is that you get to meet people that are true rock and roll people musically. I remember when I started, everybody kept saying, this is not going to last, you know.
Rock and roll itself is,
you know, it's fine to be diverse and that, you know, you can have some kind of relationship with your music. Because music is my life. It is the only communication I have personally to, in some cases, have sacrificed friendships and stuff over it because of how it affects other people. And it's, you know, my roots are in rock and roll because I started in classical music, and the first thing I ran off to was to try to play jazz and then understand why this thing would take me over. And it does overtake you. And 30 years later, people are saying, well, I don't know how much longer this thing is going to last, you know. And I go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and there are people older than me there.
Isn't that amazing? When Buddy Holly's plane went down in 59, when Elvis went to the Army within 12 months of that, when Jerry Lee Lewis got scandalized with his marriage to his cousin, particularly in England, that was the first time they told us it was all over.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, and I remember many, many years later, I asked this question of Sinatra because in 93, I guess, it was in the back of my mind somehow to, after seeing him, I thought, I need to make a record with duets. I mean, why wouldn't all of the genres of music come together over a guy who's beyond being an icon, who's been in it 50 years. And I'd mentioned Bono. Now, he knew who Bono was. I've told this story before, but it's hard to believe that this twinkle in his eye, and he said, you really can get Bono to sing with me? And I said, absolutely. I said, who wouldn't want to sing with you? And he said, I don't know. I mean, I've been doing this for so long, I don't think about it. And I was tempted to ask him how his relationship to Presley was, because there's that great little kinescope of he and Presley sing a duet way back.
Whoa.
I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I don't know that I have.
Well, he sings Love Me Tender. And
wow.
And Elvis is singing, I think Come Fly With Me or some some opposite, you know. And the cute thing about this whole thing was when Bono did work, and Bono had this tremendous and has a tremendous kind of it's the same star thing that Abby has, this amazing magnetism that you absolutely believe, you're comfortable with it. And Frank said, well, you know what's going to happen? My grandchildren are going to finally think I'm okay. I'm cool. And I said, yeah, you are cool. It's exactly, you know, what we've been talking about here.
Indulge me for a second. Let me tell you the other side of that story.
Okay.
You're right. I think it was 93. I fly to Dublin. I get off the plane. I go to the hotel without any sleep. I hook up with you two. So we're sitting in my hotel room. We do the interview. And as we're, I guess we were adjusting mics or setting levels or something like that, stuff like that. Bono looks at me and he goes, you know who's in town tomorrow? And I'm thinking, who's in town tomorrow? No. He goes, Frank's in town tomorrow. And I'm like, Frank? You mean Sinatra? And I'm thinking, I read the Dublin paper. I didn't see anything about Sinatra playing Dublin. I certainly would know that.
Uh-huh.
He goes, well, he's not really in town, but I'm singing with him.
Oh, cool.
And I said, well, I'm sorry, I don't follow you. He goes, I'm singing a duet tomorrow here in Dublin with Frank Sinatra. But Frank's not going to be.
Right.
And I'm like, what? And then when I see this on your considerable resume, that this was the first, where I'm going with this is, you did something with technology on that duets album.
Right.
With Bono and others, I guess, that really had never been done before. Tell us what you did and what technology allowed you to do it this way. And then let's talk about the how that affects the creative process, the creative possibilities.
Right. Well, most of my life, I started out as a musician as a child, but the technology end was always the thing that fascinated me. And I'd played violin and it sounded awful and, you know, who to blame but me. But I also realized that there were other sounds and guitar amps never sounded in rock and roll like they should and so forth. And so I've always been trying to find something new and develop new ways in which we could hear things better. And what happened here was I was working at Skywalker, which is the ranch that George Lucas has. And I was recording there with a young band, and I saw them doing lip sync, meaning they bring the actors in and rework some of the production, which may have had helicopter noises and other stuff. So they redo the dialogue, except the dialogue was being done where we were, which is in Northern California, and the actors were down in Santa Monica. So I said, oh, I like this. This is my style.
How was that pulled off?
Well, they were using fiber optic technology. They were using telephone lines. Now, I had been involved with this kind of experiment way back in the mid-70s with Barbara Streisand. We did a movie and we did Star Is Born. And the problem was that Warner Brothers Burbank is, from a driving point of view, probably the eight of the worst miles between there to go down to Todd Hill. And I called the telephone company, and the guy kind of knew me, and he said, oh, you're that crazy guy that likes to rent telephone lines to do music. And I said, yeah, that's me. He said, well, I'll tell you, we're working with our first satellite off of Mount Wilson. So at that point, we rented 40 lines, and we're bouncing them off two dishes. Now, the noise factor, and I was working with Dolby, we got it quiet, and it was pretty darn good. But here we are in the early 90s, and I'm watching this thing, and I said, look, to the guys who ran this system. I said, look, I'd like to try this with music. Has anybody done this? He said, well, not really. So I said, hook me up, you know. And so I ran an experiment actually on a Christmas album that I was doing with Gloria Estefan. She was in Miami. We had the band in L.A., and she was singing. And there were time lags and all kinds of things to deal with. But in a matter of 3-4 months, I figured out a lot of ways to work with this digital network. EDNet was Entertainment Digital Network. These were guys who worked at Skywalker who started this company. Mm-hmm. So what it came down to a few months later was I had finally, through haranguing and hanging out and talking to Elliot Weissman, who was the manager for Sinatra, I said, look, I really want to do this album. He's 77 or something. Let's not kid around. He's singing his butt off. It's so good. Let's see if I can get an album. He said, well, you know, his patience level, he won't go back. He hasn't been in the studio except with you and Quincy Jones 10 years ago.
Wow.
So it's not something that was an easy call. And so I sat with him and I described it. You can imagine, it's like telling your father, you know, that there's new telecommunication, and he's kind of going, yeah, right. And then he said, I know you know this stuff, kid. He calls me kid, right?
He calls everybody kid.
Everybody. And he said, I don't understand it. But you mean someone's going to be in a studio somewhere else? I said, you've watched the news. You see CNN or somebody does a newscast, and they take you to somebody who's doing the report, and they're communicating. Both of them are talking at the same time. However, you don't know this, and the audience doesn't. There's a slight lag. We have to figure out how far that lag is. But that's my problem. When you sing, you'll sing in time, and they'll sing in time. And because of the shortage of the not knowing when Frank was going to actually be ready to record and why he was going to record, the stories are plentiful. There's a book and a half in the way he came to these sessions and the way he came about. But after I finished the first one, after he had recorded and he had heard how this worked, he was just so fascinated. And I think the audience, from a point of view of, there were plenty of critics, you know, plenty of guys saying, oh, come on, you know, that's jive. It's not a true duet. It's not two people in the same studio. And it's not. And I try to explain that at this point in his life, he wasn't about to commit that easily to make a record. And secondly, to study the harmony parts and figure out the choruses and where we're going to go here. So the technology was a tremendous addition. I don't think I would have done the album except to travel around the world to get these artists. Might have taken 6 months. And it wasn't going to be the right thing to do unless we had this moment. And we caught all those moments within a 6-week period.
That is mind-boggling. That you were able to do that in that time frame.
Yeah. I obviously went to certain cities where there were certain artists. But I wanted to be there. I was with Aretha Franklin in the studio in Detroit because she doesn't like to fly, and mm-hmm. we would have waited. And later on in the next time around, Anita Baker used this technology to record her vocals. So we didn't have to go to Detroit. Not that I don't want to be in Detroit, but, you know, how can I be in Detroit and Nashville at the same day?
Right. So this series of firsts, I noticed that when it comes to film, you've done some firsts in the film business, but I noticed that there's always been a musical connection, even to film, mm-hmm. whether it's Streisand and Star is Born and the first there, and or One Trick Pony, Paul Simon,
right.
and using, I think, fiber optics then?
Well, that was the first optical.
Optical.
You know, surround sound. We had done it in magnetic, and it was very impractical, but it was wonderful. But working with Dolby to change the theater business, you know, if it wasn't for Streisand, in actual fact, and Streisand had a group of actors who had started a company called First Artists, and it was kind of like United Artists, you know. It had Paul Newman and Dustin Hoffman and several other people. And the idea was they would make movies for the right economics, but they would choose the script and they would either direct or pick the director. This was the beginning of the end of the low-paid or before you saw the major salary changes, because producers and film companies changed right then. And I begged Barbara, because she said, look, the only way I'll know this movie is if we can convince Warner that we can record live. There's not a moment in that film that isn't recorded live. There's no lip sync. If you look carefully, if it's out of sync, it's because of the editing or something we did wrong. However, the most important part was I said there was a new invention and we needed to play this in full stereophonic front and rear projection, rear sound, surround sound. So Dolby offered us a package. It was $5,000 for each theater. And First Artist paid for something like 25 theaters to be equipped.
To be installed with this?
Yeah.
Hardware.
Theater owners were not anxious to make a change and a widescreen.
No. They didn't see where it would make a difference on their bottom line.
No. As a matter of fact, many times that I've been involved with parts of new inventions is that the hardest part is to convince the business world that it's going to go somewhere, you know, that it's going to work for the change of the industry. I mean, I remember coming with the first CD, people saying, oh, no. And I went to a radio station and played it in New York and then went across four or five stations. And to go back to the very first question you asked, why would I be out on the road? The only place to learn and understand what's going on is to be out on the road.
Good for you.
You know, I don't know any other way.
This is the real world out here. Between there's definitely a bi-coastal bias.
You bet.
To the entertainment business. If it's not happening in New York, L.A., or London, you know, it ain't happening at all. And, of course, that's absurd.
Totally
absurd. This is where the industry is funded, is right out here.
Always. And the thing about it is you learn from going out. I went to these small theaters and where we put in, and I tuned them and equalized them, and it was a lot of experimentation. But got the movie to sound so good. Now, critically, the movie was not acclaimed as a great movie, but be that as it may, musically, it stood up. It had the feeling of being at a concert. That's the hardest thing in the world to do. You know, a record is the hardest place to make somebody reinvent the moment of a live concert. So sort of my goal all along has been to try to have somebody experience something that is not only visceral, but has this audio side, because I still think that the mystery of music is that you hear it and you feel it. And it's so unpredictable how your emotions are going to be. You could be brought to tears without even knowing why. So I'm fascinated. And having a big movie screen in front of you was the challenge. And having the artist who said, I trust you to make me sound good live. And that it threw a whole bunch of other challenges. And that technology led to the next one, which was an easier way for the theater owners. I remember the first time we put up the word Dolby on a marquee. The guy said, what's that? I said, well, Dolby Surround, it's kind of good for us to say that. Well, you know, 2 years later, people just took it automatically.
They got it now in their homes.
And the adventure films were the first to capture it.
They really did.
And I had seen James Bond movies with a lot of great effects, but when they started to get serious about taking us through fires and storms, I said, this is it. So we're part of these discoveries are all based on the fact that through each period we come to, as we are now in the internet world, and that kind of will lead me back to what you asked me, why would I do this? Why would I go to N2K? Why would I even think of running a record company? It's about the last thing I wanted to do. Except one of the most exciting things is to say, how can you connect people up? What's the next generation of audience? Where do we come from? Where do we want to go? How can we make the internet sound better? I mean, it was pretty awful. And it's only starting to sound reasonably well. Well, radio will be one of the great moments on the internet. There's no question that it, even now in the streaming of some stations that we're experimenting with, there's an audience that is in an office, that's on a computer, there's so many screens that they need to hear something that they enjoy. So it's now to plug in the radio right into your computer is pretty much the natural thing to think of. So that's one of the screens that I think about. It means more place for an artist to have a development, a place to teach them how to entertain and not worry about being stars right away. I mean, the great thing about rock and roll in its inception is that you make music and you start somewhere, whether it be a garage or in some little club where they sell beer, and the audience, after 2-3 years of you working your head off till you get it right, you get something going between you and an audience, and we make a record, and somehow that communicates the next phase. A lot of that's gone away because of the stardom problem of trying to be big stars too early, too much in front of them, and too much dollars that don't make sense. And I think a lot of people played in arena rock should have played more gigs before they got there. So for me to build a label with people who are desperately anxious to make good music, who will stick by me and take the hard road and work the road and go around the country, if I don't set the example for them, it won't ever happen. And I'm totally cool with this because I've been on the road with almost every artist I've ever produced.
Really?
Absolutely.
Really?
Did the sound. My biggest thing was, if I made a good record and you liked that, when you went to the concert, how many times did you walk out and say, God, if the sound was better?
Yeah.
You know, and I
probably, not so much nowadays.
No,
but
now it's cool.
But probably 40-50% of the time.
15 years ago or so, somewhere in that vicinity, when sound started to get better, it was a climb between how deaf you wanted to make the audience,
right,
or how good you could make it. And I was in favor of... And I was working and going to see artists like Bruce Springsteen and Billy. I was, of course, involved in it. And Billy Joel had expanded from an hour to 2 hours, and then 2 hours and 30 minutes nonstop. Now, if you're going to kick people's heads and turn it up and crank and turn the subwoofers on and all of that stuff, you have to get into the invention of how to please people. And that kind of arena rock is hard to do. And it wasn't, the equipment wasn't around. And we went back to clubs. As a matter of fact, we did Songs in the Attic because we wanted to go back to find out the feel of a club again. He played a year's worth of arenas. And it's great, but it has a different feel. And every night that I was out, and I'd be out for maybe 5-6 days at a time with him, I learned another thing about an audience. And it really keeps you from getting cocky. It stops you from jumping up and down and saying, I think I know the formula, because there's no formula. And you stick to your music. And your music is the roots for all of this. And any success that I've been involved in is based around some really good artists and great songs. And if you take that and then you improve the technology, then all of this stuff that's so unpredictable works. You know, and I will never sacrifice an artist for some technology. I've been known to roll a piece of tape or roll a cassette, and you know that's why when
and
the better
bump it up to,
and bump it up, yeah,
just because the magic was there.
Yeah, there was a guy named John Cicada, who's a wonderful artist, and Emilio Stefan had said to me, "Could you mix some of these tunes for us? You're a good luck charm, and when you get on behind the board, something happens." And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to." And I was listening to John's original vocals, which were on a little 4-track. And I noticed, and I said to him, either, you know, those are better performances than the next overdub stage when you come back in and you try to do it better. And we all think we can do it better. I would mix for the next 10 years the same song if somebody let me, but I've got another discipline to change. And when I realized what we could do, and with some technology, you can really change the aspect of what that is and keep the performance. Well, I'm a nutcase for that now. I've always rolled the tape from the minute people walked in. I've always believed in the spontaneity of an artist and what we can come from and how to make it better. And I don't think, I guess years of working with Paul Simon, who was an incredible perfectionist, but less of a perfectionist with me than he was with other people. He allowed me to use moments, and that's why I went to, you know, the streets of Brazil and recorded stuff with him in the middle of nowhere, because I have a different attitude about where the music comes from. And it comes from the streets, and it comes from the sometimes urban and not urban areas, going into the country world, you know. You really understand that music just comes when it comes. So you got to be prepared.
Give me an example of a musician, a performer, who basically, they had it all in their head. And basically, if you were to be totally honest, all you really did was push the faders up, and they had the song, they had the vision. Basically, all you had to do was take a snapshot in the studio, and then give me the totally opposite example of somebody that you worked with, who, if they were here right now, they'd say, definitely, Phil Ramone was a major player in my sound and my success. Just look at what I did before I worked with Phil, and then look what I did afterwards. So give me the extremes.
Well, you mentioned Alfie. You mentioned Burt Bacharach as a producer. I was the more of the engineer, and certainly was not in any sense more than the great photographer.
Yeah, there you go. But I'm saying, when I looked at that list of the people that you've worked with, I mean, that's a soundtrack of my life that you've worked on in some capacity. It's awesome, the list, and I use that word very carefully. I don't use it a lot, and almost intimidating for somebody who loves music like me to go, oh my God, I got to talk to this guy. As a producer, give me the bookends.
The bookend for me, for instance, there was an artist named Nielsen. Harry Nielsen,
who unfortunately passed away.
Yeah, and one of my favorite people. But Harry sang Everybody's Talking. We did a movie together. It was my first movie,
I
guess.
Midnight Cowboy.
And John Barry had brought him into the studio. It was like butter and toast. I mean, all the parts melted together, and I produced this record. And I think at the time meant an awful lot to me, because it was the first chance for me to step away from being an engineer and getting judged as a producer. But to give myself credit for that record, in the sense of how it rolled, it was all out of Harry's mouth. It was all the way he twisted his face and sang. There in that particular case, I think, is the complete unique human being. Now, I don't think, and I don't think whether you think Phil Spector or any of the were people who I idolized or who did unusual records. The thing that happens between you and an artist is the difference between, I've saw Billy Joel on an interview recently where he talked about our relationship. Now, Billy Joel certainly had done, before he met me, Piano Man, and had written probably some of the best records. Turnstiles was one of my favorite records. But
not a commercially successful album for Billy.
And certainly, whatever it is that comes between two people, it's a marriage that 10 years that we spent together had moments of grandiose and sometimes silliness that makes the record come to life. That relationship, for me, is truly what I feel I am as a producer, is that something happens when he walks in and he has an idle thought and a melody, and in minutes or hours or days, the trust between us. So that the suggestions, even sometimes I would prod him just unmercifully about lyric, because I said, if you don't write this third verse and make it different. And he'd say to me, why? It's good, what I think I'm saying here. I said, yeah, well, then you're in for it. Now I'm going to write the third verse, and you know what's going to happen. And, of course, the humor and the push and shove is what you don't know in a relationship, except years later. I would never have known what I did or am accused of or even accepted as being good or bad, except the records worked. But past success, you have to look at what you're talking about here in a relationship. I think that Billy, in many cases, has given me an awful lot of credit for things that happened, because he could have and did many times make records without people like me, and he certainly made a good record. There's no question about it. But there is something that comes together in the teaming of and I compare it to film. I think of Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas and a few of the great directors meet or see each other in a screening room, something happens. And what is it? I mean, it could be as simple as Spielberg saying, you know, I think that scene could be so much better if so-and-so or this line were deleted or added. Talent is there all the time. There was a young guy, John Lennon's son, who, when I did Julian Lennon, everybody thought it was a novelty.
I got to admit, remember how we started this interview?
Yeah.
Well, my antenna were up for that, too. And,
exactly.
And until I heard Velat, and then I realized I was...
But it was 2 years in very... Ahmed Erdogan trusted a relationship, and I took him out of New York. I took him to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and took him to places. The things that worked for him, and although, again, accused of trying to manufacture a voice that sounded like John Lennon was about as insane when people accuse you of that. But I think the relationship is what counts in the way musicians talk to each other. And I think it's the same kind of spiritual thing that happens to you when you I've walked into a room with artists and nothing happens. I mean, for either one of us. And, you know, that's unfortunate.
There's not a list on your resume of the ones that didn't work, is there?
No. I don't think you would know them. Half of them are things and failures that had to do with... I took my ego a long time ago and figured out where it belongs. And look, Beard, do you know what I'm talking about? There is a tremendous drive and ego in all of us that makes us be what we are. But if you're going to be in a position and not be a servant and not be a yes man, because you can't be a yes person to the talent you're working with.
You're not doing your job.
You're not doing anything for them. You never are.
Certainly not helping them realize their vision.
And the emperor's clothes problem is very good. Constant in our business, you know.
Very good.
And I think that to be given credit for the job you do, I've never stopped to say, well, I know what I did here and I helped this verse or this chorus to explode and it became this. You know, I remember Billy and I were managed by, unfortunately, a manager who turned out to be not so wonderful later on. But at the time, we had made Nylon Curtain. And Nylon Curtain for us was a tremendous undertaking at the time. It was our look at where the Beatles had been and where some of the creative rock people had gone. And not space cadets, but they had become really interesting musically. And, you know, that's that pretentious line that you walk. You could be totally pretentious and say, oh, well, I've done my symphony. I hope you like my novel here. And the audience says, bye-bye. And, of course, it dropped in sales. See, so we were judged by sales. And the guy, I learned this expression from the manager. He called it the nylon schmata, which I guess the word schmata means bad clothing or
Sounds
something.
Sounds Yiddish to me.
It is. It is. It's a word that... And he, being Irish, coming out of his mouth, I always laughed. Little did I know he was planning other thoughts about where our careers were going. But the years later, I was at a concert just recently to see Billy, and he did a couple of songs from Nylon Curtain. And a total different attitude from an audience, a new audience, many, many young people there that couldn't have been born when we made that record or were puppies, you know. They were 10 or something when we did that.
Sure.
And I think that these are the landmarks that later on you say, well, that's a good watermark. This one's okay. This means something. It frightens me. I had a terrible experience last year. They issued a record out that I'd made 16 years ago with Karen Carpenter.
Wow.
And truthfully, I would have preferred that it never come out. Mm. But because of my love for Karen and the fact that it was a piece of music made in 1979, had a lot of disco in it, and it was a lot of other things that were in it, it's one of the few records that I'd made that I felt I had missed in some areas by dating the music, dating it in a calendar format, which I would never do again, never. But in your growing period, as you're working with an artist and they come to the room and they see they would like to wear a red dress and have the silver balloons and the mirror ball, you say, yeah, why not? You know, I'm in rock and roll. I can do anything I want. And it's sometimes it's a bad thing to think about later is that you should have talked them out of it. You know, it's too high style, too high profile, too much to say.
Too flavor of the month.
Yeah, and as you say, the high antenna comes out because one of the biggest things I think fails for anybody that makes good music is when you start to believe your press or you start to act as almost a caricature of the sound you made before. And as a producer, that's probably the most important thing I do when I'm driving along here. You know, if I'm listening to a radio station, I can tell from its feel whether I'm hearing something that's straight ahead or it isn't. And it's hard to say that to people because I grew up with FM. I mean, in my later years, that was my favorite thing to do, was to be on FM or be a part of it. I don't know if you know, that was in 1970 in New York. New York had been deserted by the record companies, and they'd gone.
I didn't realize that.
And I was part owner of a studio called A&R Recording.
Sure.
It was a historic joint.
Yes, it is.
And there was a station called WPLJ.
Mm-hmm.
And the first artist we put on the air live with some wine and cheese for the kids was Elton John. And that became 1170.
Wow.
So we did a once-a-month show for 2 years with some of the greatest artists
wow.
in the world. And I've never forgotten how important that was. You know, when you speak to people who do radio now and how hard it is to access all the things that are sort of, this is a formula, this is a success, and this is what it is. It's a pleasure just to sit here and talk.
Oh, thanks.
You know, because it means a lot to me, because there is a place for me to understand what it is that I'm doing. You know, I preach to the artists all the time. It's the song, and each song, if it successively does what it's supposed to do, the 10 will make sense somehow, because only those of us who make the record actually listen to all 10 in a row.
That's true.
Our audience doesn't do that.
Thanks. The last thing, and this could go on for a year or two, this debate. There are times, I mean, it's a bell curve. It's a roller coaster to watch the ebb and flow of popular music in America. You know, we ended up talking about when rock and roll was supposed to be DOA in 59 and 60
right.
and 61, and then of course you have the British invasion, the Beatles, and it ebbs and flows all the time. It seems to me that right now, in general, rock and roll seems to be kind of in one of those ebb times where we're waiting for the next big thing, and it almost seems to me, and you're certainly the man to ask this since you both do the creative and your cutting-edge technology, it seems to me that distribution systems, the internet, and digital technology it seems to be a little ahead of the curve. It seems like it's a time now for hardware and distribution is just taking off, and it's almost like the horse is out of the barnyard, but the rider got bumped his head on the way out the barn door and is sprawled back in the barnyard.
Right.
Is that fair?
It is
to
fair.
Say?
It is fair, except that I think the one good thing that happens when we talk about technology in the less than 5 years, that even the thought pattern of putting music out on the internet, and you know, there are all these fears. I just to preach one thing, I think people will always go to stores. I believe that we all go out dancing together. We don't stay at home. We don't watch television and not.
Okay, what you're alluding to is the prediction by a lot to be the cottaging effect, where you won't go out. You'll buy your music over the internet. You'll bring it in. You'll pipe it in through
right.
Cables and satellites and everything into your home, and you won't go out. Of course, that's why Disney sued Sony back in the early 70s, and they said that videotape was going to kill the movie industry.
Exactly.
And, of course, they couldn't have been more wrong. Remember that scene?
Yeah, oh, very much. That scenario. I'm going to be speaking again next week, to a group of retailers on the very essence of the fact that new technology brings you two things. It's a new place for screening and hearing and tasting and getting a shot at hearing new information. if we keep the canvas, as I call it, limited to the way it always will be or has been, we will never get new acts. We will never hear new music. Rock and roll has to have, you know, because of the formulas and because of the styles, one shouldn't be making a record, this is personal with me, that's in style today, because it's 9 months old by the time you get it anyhow.
Oh, minimum.
You know, and we're forcing people to say, and I think a lot of record companies have said this, you know, I want a record like so-and-so, and why don't we have a group like so-and-so? And when you break the mold is all of the cottage industry type people, the ma and pa stores, the people who make music in a smaller sense have a place to live right now. We can make a CD and put it out on the internet so you can taste it and maybe you go to your store and find it, or you buy it direct. That does not preclude the fact that the big six will not continue to be hugely successful.
You're talking about the retailers?
Yeah.
Or the
manufacturers? No, the big record companies.
Manufacturers.
But the style of how we will produce music will always remain the same basic elements, you know. But what do we do with it, and how do we get it to the audience, and how do we get to a larger audience? I mean, there are 40 million people who sit in front of a computer every day that are online. They can't look at that computer for 7 or 8 hours without a break, or not want to hear something or know something. And information is absorbed so much quicker now. You can get incredible amounts of news in 30 seconds. You can do highlights of a song. You can give people different attitudes towards what would I like to do tonight, and where would I like to be, and who should I see, and maybe I'll listen to this broadcast. Because we are what I call the minor leagues, in a sense. The internet at the moment is the minor league to the major stations. The major stations will have a secondary unit. I would promise you very shortly that I would think you and other great people who like to talk and can give an interview and also play music of their own choice, where there is not a time schedule, and maybe because we're not talking about 10 or 12 hours or a drive or what time this has gone on.
Time shifting is something that...
It's 24 hours a day in a different country.
Yeah. The thing that popped into my mind as you were describing the time factor is, I think it's ABC News now. They have a slug line at the end of all their news shows. It says, always on.
Yeah.
Two words, always on. And it's very powerful. In other words, when it's good for you to get this information, it's available now.
Right.
In another way.
Yeah, and let's say we wanted, I mean, it's simple. You wanted to hear a concert, you couldn't get there, but it was cyber broadcast last night, and the quality is better.
It's stored, right?
It's yours.
Yeah, you can.
It's yours shift. To listen and you know, I keep saying to them, it's a living billboard of advertising and information. No matter what you do, it's there. If you ignore it, it will not go away. It'll never go away. Even if they put every restriction that the FCC has done over the years in broadcast, it won't apply. Because it is a new, free football field, and
you can't.
It's an art field.
History, very good. History has proven that you cannot hold back the technology, and the wise person makes it work for him or her, right?
Yeah.
Make it work for you.
And cater to your audience, you know. You do that in all the other worlds that we try to make something successful. We want to be appreciated. We want the artist to be appreciated. Why wouldn't we want a bigger and better place to enjoy it? I spoke to a whole bunch of people who are in the entertainment world, including many radio people, and I said, you know, it'd be nice to hear you chat for me. I wouldn't mind hearing you talk about the making of that record, how you like to play this, and I'd buy that hour, and I could store it on my hard disk and hear that at a time when maybe I just want to spend 30 minutes and chill. So, you know, and then I'll go back to your live radio station and still interact between the two. And that's really what the minor league, major league attitude thing I have about it is. And I think we're headed to probably the best changes that we've ever experienced, obviously in this century.
It's exciting.
It's great.
It's very exciting. We've been talking with Phil Ramone, who is president of N2K Encoded Music and also the chairman of the National Association of Recording Arts and Sciences. And also, he is not just a name, but a musical force in about probably three quarters of your album collection at home. I'm Redbeard on Q102.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.